change of department head audits, and I'm going to ask Kathy and Mary to Nancy. It was close. I apologize, Nancy. And what we're going to do is they're going to give us a little discussion about these types of audits and what they're about and that sort of thing, and answer questions that we might have. And then, members, what I'm going to do is that I will then open a public hearing on House Bill 2027 after we've done the informational hearing. I just want us to have the background about why these audits are done. And so, Kathy, let me turn it over to you.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, for the record, Kathy Polino with the Secretary of State Audits Division. One thing that I might want to do is if I can point you to House Bill 2027, because the language of the change of directive statute is in there, so you can see and kind of follow along with me. On page 2 of that bill, and it's lines 25 through 27, is the statutory requirement for change of director audits or reviews. I want to say that it was about 10 years ago we started going back through all the statutes and saying, well, what is it that, are there any statutory audit requirements that are out there that we may or may not be aware of? This is one of those ones that we took a look at. And as you can see from the language in the statute, it's not very specific on what exactly we're trying to get from this auditor review. It just says that we should go in and do a review whenever the agency head, and the word in here says retires. In our discussions with the Department of Justice, they've told us that really kind of the concept is whenever the head of an agency leaves their position, some kind of an audit or a review should take place to kind of take a look at the agency. They couldn't provide us any other further direction on what it really means. So about 10 years ago, we started going in and doing a lot more detailed review anytime an agency had left their position. We did a full-blown audit where we looked at a number of different things, everything from payroll that was under their control to travel claims, contracts they might have entered into, just any sort of thing that we thought, well, what is it that a new director might want to know coming into an organization? What is kind of that clean bill of health that they're looking for when they come in as a new director? So we have, over the last few years, when we first started doing these, there were some pretty good findings at that time. There wasn't a lot of real thought about who should be reviewing payroll for those agency heads, who should be reviewing their travel claims. Usually in an organization you have a higher level review. Well, once you get up to the top of the organization, who then reviews their work? So some of the result that came from earlier change of director audits was a change in the Oregon Accounting Manual, which took place in 2001, which kind of laid out what are the expectations as far as agency heads and reviewing their work, and some of that oversight that wasn't there. So there was some good value that came out when we first really got in and started doing some of these reviews. Over time, the value seems to have diminished as we've done these, especially when we've gone back to some of these agencies that have changed agency heads many times in the last few years. The value of that particular review has diminished. Over the last three fiscal years, we've done, I think, 47 of these reviews. This is there's a requirement that we go do something. We've been going in and doing these audits. Usually when a new governor comes in, we do see a larger change in agency heads. Those 47 reviews have cost us somewhere in the neighborhood of about $800,000 of audit resources that we've devoted to these reviews. And maybe to put this into a little context, some of these are very, very small reviews. We spend maybe 20 some hours on some of these, so about $2,000 is what on the small end that these cost. On the farther end, some of these may take us 1,100 or 1,200 hours. And let me give you two examples, and that's somewhere in about the $70,000, $75,000 range as far as the cost of the audit. One of them was at the Commission of Hispanic Affairs, and that was a couple years ago. There were actually some problems with the executive director was spending some of the commission's money on personal items was traveling and doing things not necessarily related to his business, was establishing contracts with his family, those sort of things. And so those kinds of reviews obviously take a little bit longer than those that, you know, we go in and they're a little bit cleaner. Another example is we had a change up at the Department of Environmental Quality, and that's an agency that we only do a teeny bit of work at every year as part of our statewide financial work, and it's one that we haven't been to for a while. So as part of the director change, we went in and did a management risk assessment, and actually got some pretty good feedback on that. The new director coming in was happy to get an assessment from an independent source like us of where their management risks are. And, you know, this is one of those agencies that doesn't have an internal auditor, at least at the time we did the review. And so the new director coming in appreciated getting some of that information on where they should focus their efforts. So those are ones that cost a little bit more money than some of the others. With that background, and I don't want to leak into House Bill 2027 quite yet, but the concept of making sure that the resources and the limited resources that we have to do audit work are focused in the highest risk area is real important to us. And the concept of having the agency head leaving being the trigger for an audit to us doesn't necessarily make sense, that there are other factors that should be taken into account before an audit is triggered. And so I guess with that said, Nancy is here to talk about the higher ed audit change of director review if you have any questions on that. But we're kind of open to you and any questions you might have.
Okay. Before we proceed, are there any questions for Kathy? Okay, Nancy, if you would go ahead and just kind of walk us through a little bit the and I realize this is kind of a short letter and everything and that Chancellor Jarvis had been with us for a pretty short period of time, but maybe what you could do would be to walk through a little bit about what sorts of things you looked at, what sorts of things you found with this, and I guess the sort of the overarching question. Is this kind of a good example of what the change of director review or audit really looks like? And maybe then let us know by, you know, backing it up in the terms of the bill. It's a financial review as opposed to a full blown audit. How would this have changed if you were just doing a financial review as opposed to the full-blown audit?
Okay. Representative Cromwell, members of the committee, my name is Nancy Young. I'm an audit manager with the Secretary of State Audits Division, and we did perform a change of director review when Chancellor Garvis resigned with the Oregon University System. I'll just run through those items that we looked at and kind of what we found. We looked at the assets that were assigned to the former chancellor, and we found that all of those had been returned upon his departure. We did find, however, that the university system did not necessarily have the documentation on hand for all of the items that had been issued to the chancellor, but that's kind of a minor issue. Next, we looked at travel reimbursements that were submitted by the former chancellor during the last 3 months of his employment, and we found that those travel reimbursements complied with the applicable laws and regulations. We looked at the payroll disbursements and leave accruals during the last 3 months of his employment and found that they were appropriate and accurate. We looked at phone usage from the former chancellor for the last 3 months, and we did find that in 1 month there was kind of an increased activity during that time, and we questioned the purpose of those calls and asked the former chancellor to describe to us what, you know, which ones were business calls and which ones were personal calls, and there came down to a few calls that it just would have taken more time to research, and so he just went ahead and paid for those calls and reimbursed the Oregon University System for them. So we have no concerns regarding those calls whatsoever. We also looked at a final payout. We also looked at personal service contracts and found that there was none signed or approved by the former chancellor before his final departure.
a little bit different in this change of director is that we also looked at a final payment that was made to the chancellor upon his departure. This was a contracted negotiation between the Oregon University System and the former chancellor, and that required that there to be a lump sum payment of $250,000 minus any benefits received during that period of time. So, for example, medical insurance that was paid on his behalf would be deducted from the $250,000. Okay. We reviewed the $250,000 and everything that was deducted from that amount and found that that the calculation was correct. However, we did question 15 hours of vacation that amounted to $1,270 that was not deducted from that $250,000 balance. The contract itself is unclear as to what was to be considered benefits, and so much of it is left up to interpretation. Because the university system's policy says that vacation leave earned in 1 month cannot be used until the next month, the 15 hours earned during his last month of employment with the university system therefore would not have been available until after he had already left. Therefore, we felt that that 15 hours possibly should have been deducted from the $250,000 payout. We recommended that the university system check with their legal counsel for further clarification on what was intended, and if it should have been deducted, then we recommended that they seek reimbursement from the former chancellor. So that pretty much summarizes.
Okay.
Did you want to ask some questions?
Let me go back if I could with regards to the assets that were assigned to him. What kind of assets are you looking at? Is that like office desk and chair and credenza and computers and that sort of thing? For example, and with the chancellor, is there a home involved? Is there are there cars involved? Those sorts of things.
Yeah, Representative Chair Krummel. Yes, that would be correct. We look at cell phones. If a computer, like a laptop computer, was issued to the former chancellor, a vehicle that was issued to them, if they vacated the home and left it in kind of good condition, that type of thing. And we had no concerns. We found that everything that had been issued to them, including like keys, just locking keys, key cards, all of those types of items had been returned to the university system. And we found that all of those had been returned to the university system. We had no concerns.
Okay. And with regards to travel reimbursements, you were just primarily checking to make sure that any travel had been actually on university business and not either on personal business or looking for another position, that sort of thing.
Yeah, that would be correct. Yes, we found that all travel during that period of time was appropriate and related to the Oregon University System business.
Okay. Are there any other questions?
I just have one question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, we recognize the Oregon University System has sets its own payroll programs and has its own standards. Relative to the request that legal counsel be sought relative to the termination and vacation hours accrued and those kinds of things, is that an issue that we see uniformly as a problem throughout state government, or was the Oregon University System unique in their approach? And if this has been corrected by the Oregon University System, this approach, has it also been uniformly recommended throughout state government that we examine those contracts for these golden parachutes?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, the $250,000 payout is, I would say, more of a unique occurrence. We don't see that in every change of director review that we do, so it's pretty rare. But I would say that for the university system, that's not necessarily a rare occurrence or something unusual for them to do.
And so the question is, Mr. Chair, is the discussion relative to the accrued versus when it was due and payable as to the 15 hours of vacation time for the $1,370, I assume that that was addressed, that counsel was going to be sought, and the response from the Oregon University System on February 24th indicates that we will seek the legal counsel advice from the Oregon University System and take appropriate action. I'm wondering, is this an item that other directors and other agencies that we have an issue with that needs to be clarified, rather than just seeking the counsel for the Oregon University System and this unique contract, which I'm assuming they will address because they say they will, and then they will apply that to their own, all of their own internal contracts. But do we see that in other agencies of state government?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, we haven't seen contracts like this in any other agencies that we've done change of director reviews. So.
Okay. But finally, Mr. Chair, just to make sure, that is the and it appears that there's some considerable discussion about payroll checks being issued to include the last hours of accrued vacation during the month of June when the final paycheck is due in June. Is that a problem in the Department of Administrative Services with their director when they change directors?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, I'm not sure. That's something we could take a look at. I don't know how this applies to other agencies.
I'm just making sure that we have some uniformity throughout the state as to how we calculate these departure payments or accruals at the time that they're finalized. I mean, if it's a problem for the Oregon University System, it might well be a problem. And of course, 15 hours for $1,370 isn't any small amount. And I'm just anxious that in other agencies that we have the same kinds of checks and balances, that we know what we're accruing and when it's due and payable. If they're leaving in a month when the vacation is just accruing, do we owe it to them as they depart? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Brown.
To help me understand this, but on the second page in that second paragraph there, the one that, so this person as director of the chancellor's office, or I have the chancellor's office, when he left, or that person left, they were paid $250,000 plus the amount of such salaries and benefits paid him in that period. And so it was $250,000 was the big figure, less some of these other things. And does the state enter into these kind of contracts? This sounds like somebody you do with something with a professional baseball player or something.
Mr. Chair, Representative Brown, in this circumstance, Chancellor Garvis's contract was terminated early, and that was a negotiation process between the Oregon University System and Chancellor Garvis. As Kathy indicated previously, this is not normal for us to see when a director leaves an agency, and if we're just to compare it to other change of director audits that we do. It is, I guess, more normal when you're looking at a university system and they're changing ahead at that level for there to be a negotiation when a contract is terminated early.
Who did the negotiating?
His agent.
Mr. Brown, my understanding is that negotiation went to DOJ.
And now, let's see, you said terminated. So he was terminated, and part of the golden parachute was this agreement here then, and what they agreed to.
Mr. Chair, Representative Brown, by terminated, I don't mean fired. He just, his employment was terminated. It was mutually agreed upon.
That's fired.
Okay, well, that's...
I really find it surprising. I didn't know this went on in state government.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Just to clarify a little bit on that. At the university system, they do have contracts with many of their employees, and so they're for a certain time period. Most agency directors aren't on a contract for a certain time period. They're at will, and once their employment ends, the employment ends. So it's not like you're signing on for a one-year, two-year contract. Most agency heads are employees that are at will, so there isn't that contract that they're dealing with when their employment ends.
So, Kathy, what is the
what is the, or is there a standard severance package type of situation? So if a director, an agency director, let's say, you know, take a different one. Well, there was a recent one with Water Resources. Of course, it wasn't because he was terminated. He was moved to a different department. But let's take that for example. If Water Resources were terminated either because it was a mutual understanding, kind of like the OUS situation, or let's say he is laid off or he is fired, are there generally some kind of severance packages that go along with these contracts, or because they're at will, when they're done, they're done?
Mr. Chair, because they're at will, when they're done, they're done. However, as part of these, we have seen some further contracts with certain directors, you know, as kind of a transition service between the time they leave and the time that the new director comes in and takes over. And we do look at those very closely because there are certain things that need to be there. You know, there needs to be some kind of defined, you know, what is it that you're doing? They're not just told to go home and, you know, if we call you when we need you. You know, there needs to be some kind of a description of the service that we're buying. The amount that we're paying needs to be commensurate with the service that they're providing. You know, and one example is the state fair director. 1 year was... I'm going to use it, terminated, but you know, he left service and the state fair was coming up in another month, and so they wanted to have him available in case questions come in, especially for the new director taking over the state fair. That's a very difficult time of year to all of a sudden take over an agency, and so there might be questions on contracts with vendors. There might be all kinds of things that one person knows about that nobody else knows about, and so we have seen some of those arrangements, but again, we look at them very closely because those are the ones that are questionable for us.
Okay. Another question. Is there anywhere in state statute that we have, or anywhere in the rules, I guess, either one, statute or rule, where either agency directors or agency financial officers, particularly the financial officers, are required to take a mandatory one-week vacation so that the either your folks or internal auditors or whomever can go in and check the books and make sure that the books are clear and that everything's being done the way it should be. I know that's something that's done particularly in the banking industry, is that bank managers are generally, or branch managers are generally required to take a one-week vacation during that time. An internal auditor goes in. We don't have that in
this case. Mr. Chair, I'm not aware of any requirement.
Okay. So, Nancy, how would this have been different? And I know it, Chancellor Jarvis hadn't been here very long, so how would this have been different had it only been required to be a financial review as opposed to an audit?
Mr. Chair, let me go ahead and answer because the term financial review, and I don't want to get it mixed up with what House Bill 2027 is doing, this particular review was a review. It wasn't a full-blown audit.
Okay.
And
that's just simply because of the amount of time since the last change of director reviewed.
That, and there are some things, you know, again, we'll talk a little bit about the term audit because it does require us to do certain things to meet auditing standards, whereas this particular review, we didn't do as many steps as we would have if we would have done a full-blown audit.
Okay.
We have over time, when we first started doing these change of director reviews, and the statute, this particular statute doesn't require an audit, it requires an audit or review. So we started doing full-blown audits, and they were very expensive, and we ended up having to devote a lot of our resources to them. And as the value that we were seeing coming from these audits was diminishing, we were pulling back on the amount of work we were doing, and we actually, ourselves, ourselves labeled, and we're going to do change of director lights, and now we're doing what we call ultra lights, which is, you know, what we're doing is we're asking the agency to kind of self-certify to us whether they did, you know, take them off the system and received all the assets. And so we ask them to make sure that that's happened, and they certify it to us, and then we're doing some spot checking on that, where we'll go in and, you know, like we'll take a look at the expenditures and make sure that nothing looks funny to us, as opposed to us going in and verifying that the, you know, this computer is here and I can see it and feel it and touch it. Okay. So we've kind of scaled back on what they are, but this is a review and not an audit.
Yeah. Okay. So a review such as this one that was done for OUS, how much does something like this cost?
This one in particular took us about 80 hours of staff time, which I think translates to about a little over $5,000. And a lot of that was its travel costs going back and forth to meet with the agency. And we were also, as part of this, following up, you know, that last contract we were talking about, there were some questions from a couple legislators or a legislator about the contract itself and whether it was okay. So we probably spent a little bit more time looking at the contract than we ordinarily would have. But yeah, about 2 weeks of a staff person time.
Okay. And and who paid that? Was it the OUS then reimbursed your office? But is that something that you bill the agencies for when you do a change of director review?
Mr. Chair, this is part of our assessment, our agency assessment. They already pay us quite a bit of money, so this is a freebie for them. The only agencies that we direct bill for on time are those trust fund agencies. So, like, if we were to go to transportation or lotteries, we bill them directly for the time. Otherwise, it's part of their overall assessment that they pay us.
Okay. Okay. Are there any other questions with regards to change of director reviews? As I was asking that, well, let me. Are there any other questions?
No? I've got a question.
Representative Brown?
To do with that, to this auditor. Does the Chancellor's Office, they answer to the Board of Higher Education, do they?
That's correct. Although, I think, I don't think the governor appoints the chancellor. I think the Board of Higher Ed does appoint the chancellor. Am I correct in that?
Yes.
Jim says I'm correct in that, and Jim knows all. Okay. If there aren't any other questions, now I notice that we have two other. Well, right now it's one, but there were two. I'm not seeing things. Other gentlemen sitting here. Were you here for the informational hearing, or did you have any comments that you wanted to make?
20.7.
Okay. Okay. Great. Great. We're going to get there. Okay, then with that, if there's not any other questions with regards to these overviews of change of department head audits, then I think what I'll do is I'll go ahead and close the informational hearing, and I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2027. And why don't we start off, Jim, with you kind of giving us a little rundown of what this bill does and.
House Bill 2027 directs the Secretary of State to enter into agreements with semi-independent state agencies, Appraiser Certification and Licensure Board, and Oregon Tourism Commission to set financial review schedules, delete requirements that Secretary set audit schedules for those entities, delete requirements that Secretary of State audit or review state agency when Director of Agency retires, delete requirement that Secretary of State post audit disbursements from the Department of Veterans Affairs Conservatorship Revolving Account, repeals requirement that Secretary of State audit account of sheriff who performs service for the state, declares an emergency effective on passage, and it has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
It does?
Yes, sir.
Why does this have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means?
Mr. Chair, I'm looking at this with all of the items that they're deleting responsibility from the Secretary of State's office. I would think this bill probably can make about $200,000 or $300,000 a year. Just take away all the things that they're not going to have to do anymore. So we just balance the budget.
All right. Okay. Well, and there is no. Did we get a fiscal impact statement from LFO?
No, sir. I think when you're referring it subsequently to Ways and Means, that they do that.
Oh, okay. Do the fiscal.
Okay.
All right. Well, Kathy, since you're already there, and since you're first on the list, why don't we go ahead and have you go ahead and give your testimony for House Bill 2027.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, Kathy Polito with the Secretary of State Audits Division. Our office is very supportive of House Bill 2027. This is actually a bill that is the result of the Interim Joint Legislative Audit Committee. And one of the work groups that came out of the Interim Committee was taking a look at some of the audit mandates that are on our office, and if there are any of them that the committee felt wasn't worth the cost benefit of doing the work, they wanted to look through all the list of the various mandates that are on our office to see if there's anything that they should remove from our requirements. And let me give you a little background on how we actually got to that point. I think the Joint Legislative Audit Committee heard me whine enough during the session about the continuing squeeze on our resources. Both, you know, we're experiencing, like the rest of state government, overall our total number of auditors over the last 10 years has gone from about 85 staff to down to about 76 staff. And then within the available resources we have, we've had an increase in the mandates that are placed on our audit as far as different audits and work that we need to do. And then on top of that, changes in the our own profession as kind of in the result of the WorldCom and the Enrons, the standard setting bodies have really beefed up the amount of work that we need to do to issue opinions on financial statements.
Okay, that's related to like Sarbanes-Oxley and some of those.
Yeah, there's some other things. They call it Statement on Auditing Standards, SAS 99, which is one that requires us to look for fraud in a bit different way than we used to. I think you've heard us talk about Government Accounting Standards Board, GASB 34, which is a new way to present financial statements. And all of this additional work, again, we've got that squeeze on our resources and then the increase in mandates. The amount of resources we have available to do things of high risk that come to our attention has been shrinking over time. And what the subcommittee was doing is they're saying, well, is there something we can do to kind of ease up on some of those mandates and requirements so that there is a little bit more flexibility so you can focus your resources on the highest risk? And so last interim, a subcommittee of the Joint Legislative Audit Committee, it was chaired by Representative Berger. Also on the committee was Senators Devlin and Winters and Representative March, members of Legislative Fiscal Office, and then folks from our office. We got together and we looked through all the statutory audit requirements, and House Bill 2027 is the results of that committee. They said, here are some requirements that we think should be deleted because of that cost benefit that we were talking about. These basically fall into, I'll put them into three categories. The change of director audits we already talked about. What this bill would do would basically just eliminate the requirement that we do it every time there is a director change. We can still do the work if something comes to our attention. Most of the audits with the major findings were not ones that came because we were there, because we had to be there. They came to our attention through other means, like the Hispanic Commission one that we talked about earlier. There was a board member that had some concerns about what they were seeing, and so we would have gone in and done that audit whether we were required to be there or not. So as far as change of director audits, the concept is to remove the requirement that we go. We can still do it, but we think it should be based on whether there's some risk factors out there as opposed to going to every single board and commission every time a director leaves. So that's the first change that House Bill 2027 does. The second thing it does is it changes the requirement for our semi-independent agencies from what's called, we use the term audit in statute right now, and what it does is it changes that term audit to a financial review. And I think if you look, just as an example, because it's kind of spread all throughout the bill, but on that first page, if you'll look at lines, that paragraph line 6 through 11, you'll see how it's changing the terminology from audit to financial review. And semi-independent agencies, we're doing about 11 of these reviews right now. We're contracting with private CPA firms to do the work. Most of these are very, very, very small boards. Just to give you some examples, the Board of Physical Therapists Licensing Board, the Board of Nursing, those are the types of boards we're talking about. And for these boards, a full-blown audit may not be necessary or make sense. Those audits are costing us somewhere in the neighborhood of $4,000 to do. And for some of these boards, about $4,000 for an audit of these small boards. And for some of them, they have such simple revenue and expenditure streams, there may be something that we could do that's less than a full-blown audit that would be just as effective, if not more effective, and cost the board less money. And so we would like to see that term change from audit to a financial review so that we have some latitude to make the review make sense and not have to do a full-blown audit. I don't know if that makes enough sense. You know, some of them have very simple, like the revenue is a license fee. So if they have 20 licensees and it's a cost of $25 a month, it's very simple to look at their revenue stream and see if it makes sense without doing a full-blown audit. And then some of them have very simple expenditure streams. They have payroll, they have rent. And so going in and doing looking at their schedule of revenue and expenditures, if they handle a lot of cash, maybe looking at their controls over cash might be a more appropriate use of our time as opposed to contracting for an audit. So it's just a kind of a technical change, picking out that audit terminology and giving us a little bit of flexibility to make the work make more sense.
Kathy, with those, because the statute says to enter into agreements. So those, for example, the physical therapy board, the nurses licensing board, those sorts of folks, they don't receive an assessment from the Secretary of State's office?
This is when they pay these directly to us. So we'll contract with a firm, and then we send the bill to them, and they pay us. So we do talk to them about the level of review we're doing. We decide how much work needs to be done. Like I said,
do you sort of give them a ballpark figure then, or you say, well, it's going to cost, you know, $75 an hour or $100 an hour, and we think that it's going to take 80 hours, or, you know, 80 times 100 is, what's that, 8,000?
Mr. Chair, as part of the budget process, we let them know in advance what we estimate their costs will be for the next biennium, and so they hopefully allocate that money and set it aside for that cost. You know, we do have contracts with some firms to do this work, so we have a pretty good idea of what an audit will cost, and we're hoping that we can ease up on that requirement and really make it make a little bit more sense.
Would there be any reason why we wouldn't want to put something in here about putting these audits out or these financial reviews out to bid? Either through your office or that or change it so that it would be up to the agency. It's a requirement that they have it done, that they may put it out to bid to the private CPA world, and their fallback would be Secretary of State's Audits Division. Is there any reason why we couldn't do that, shouldn't do that?
Mr. Chair, I think the concept is to have us kind of control contract with the contractor so we know what we're asking for.
Okay.
And I think if you look at, I guess, lines 10 and 11, it does talk about, you know, in lieu of conducting it, we can elect to contract for it, and we have been contracting for all of those. So we don't necessarily want to do this work ourselves, but I think the concept is to have an independent body contracting for the work so you get what you want as opposed to what the board wants.
Okay. Representative Butler, you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes. Kathy, the difference between the Secretary of State electing to accept the report of an independent certified public accountant or the Secretary of State contracting for the financial services certified public accountant, independent certified public accountant, is considerably have any of these boards been having work done by independent certified public accountants that weren't contracted for in the past? This is just change of language of what you're already the current practice.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, this isn't our bill. I don't know what the reason behind this particular part of the change is. I think it was to maybe clarify it so it more in line with what we're doing, is my guess, is because we have been contracting for these reviews. And I think the concept from the Legislative Audit Committee is they wanted that power to stay with our office, to be the one doing the contracting, as opposed to allowing the board to get their own and then sending it to us.
So currently the boards aren't contracting with certified public accounting firms and submitting the reports to you. Currently, either you're doing it or you're contracting out with certified public accounting. So this just codifies what the current practice is.
Right. That's correct.
Okay. Mr. Chair, just follow up.
Yes, follow up.
And particularly in relationship to, Kathy, some work that we've done with the Department of Administrative Services relative to the vendor-collected administrative fees. Well, the vendor-collected administrative fees say that, Jiminy, if you're gonna do our printing for you, and we've got a print shop downstairs, and we're gonna allow you to go and gather these other contracts together, for us to keep a list of the vendors that provide this, we're gonna tack on a service fee. What you're telling us today is that Secretary of State is able to contract for these independent either review or audit reports and contract and have a pretty good idea what the services will be contracted out at. Do you tack on some sort of a vendor collected administrative fee for that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, we have kind of a large contract already set up, and so I think we're, with most of these, we're probably spending about an hour or two to administer the contract, I mean, for all 11 contracts. So there is a very small piece of our time that is billed on this, but it's, you know, we don't go out and review the work of the CPA firms or do any of that. We're simply the conduit for the contract.
Mr. Chair, I would submit to the committee that, in like manner, that the state printing and it's the P&D, printing and what?
Printing and distribution
office under the Department of Administrative Services doesn't go out and review the printing of each printing job. They just have tacked on a fee in order to maintain that. So you don't anticipate at this particular point filling out a Form 333 and saying we're going to tack on a fee for the independent CPAs that you're contracting the work for.
No, Mr. Chair and Representative Butler, I think that the thought is since there's so many of them right now, I mean, I think we're up to 11, and I've seen a couple bills to maybe add another one or two. The concept is it'd be cheaper to have one place managing the contracts as opposed to each one of the boards having to get their own contract signed and managed. So, you know, we don't necessarily need to be in this business, but I think this is where it is right now.
Sure. I have one more high-level question relative to Kathy's comments regarding the Government Accounting Standards Practices Board and other statements and accounting opinions and so forth. SAS 99 particularly referred to, Kathy, the directive to look for fraud in different ways.
SAS is
Statement on Auditing Standards.
There we go. And I couldn't remember what it was. You said SAS, I said SAS. But I guess we both owe to the piggy bank at that point. But the SAS 99, yesterday I was in a meeting where one of our legislators had been critical of the work that had been done on certain ESD problems that we're having in some of our ESDs, and one in particular, particularly with some concern relative to the fact that the independent auditors were unable to identify where there perhaps was collusion. I'm anxious under SAS 99, where we're supposed to look for fraud in different ways. Are there new tools available to look for fraud where there's collusion?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, there are some new tools, but more of it is the old standard used to require us to be alert for fraud, which didn't really tell us to do anything proactively to look for those things as we're doing our financial work. And so now some of the things that we're doing differently is at the start of audits, when this applies, we sit down and do kind of a brainstorming session, both internally and with the agency itself to identify what are some potential areas where fraud could be occurring, what are some things that we should be looking for. So it's kind of a more proactive thought process of where are those things that could be taking place. And then we do selectively go out and test some of those controls to see if they are in place and there's some potential for that. So, it really isn't defined as far as exactly what we need to be doing, but it does give us some responsibility to do more on the front end as opposed to just being alert for those things.
Mr. Chair, I just called to the attention of the committee that Kathy used a very important term, and that is test those controls. That's the internal control, and that's why it is so very important to have managers hired who understand, who are willing to stop and read the state's financial accounting manual as to the things that we're supposed to do, and then managers who have been taught correct principles relative to internal control. I think it's so very important, whether it's gathering in the money at the end of the day and having two people independently count it and the third person accompany to the bank or at least bring back the receipt for the resource being deposited. So I think it's very, very important that we continue to make certain that the financial and the internal controls are in place and are monitored. And I would hope that Kathy's shop would still have sufficient staff resources and allocate those staff resources so that we can focus those resources on those high-risk areas.
Thank you. Are there any other questions for Kathy relative to House Bill 2027?
Okay.
Mr. Chair, just one other general comment. There is just two other statutes that it gets rid of. I think one of them requires us to audit the accounts of sheriffs if something happens. I think these are things that were put in statute 50-some years ago. We haven't been doing anything in this area. We don't know if there's any things going on that we should be doing. So part of this is a cleanup. The last two things are cleanups of some statutes that are out there. One thing I just wanted to mention before I let you all go is that House Bill 2028 was kind of, I think that kind of goes hand in hand with this. That's one that this committee heard a little while ago, which was that Joint Legislative Audit Committee bill, mm-hmm. Which changed the membership a little bit of the committee, but then also made it a standing committee. One of the reasons why I think that bill is so important, now it links up with this one, is the Joint Legislative Audit Committee was established as kind of a funneling mechanism so that when legislative committees or individual legislators have ideas about audits, they could go through a joint legislative audit committee so that the limited audit resources we have can go to those highest priority audit topics. This is kind of probably, I would guess, over time, some types of audit mandates that got stuck in the statute that maybe if the Joint Legislative Audit Committee was there and functioning, could have taken those. Maybe at the time they were important topics and we could have worked with them to do those audits at the time, but they wouldn't be in statute for 50 years or 100 years and have us doing work over time that don't make sense.
Right.
So it kind of packages these two together nicely, and I think that was the concept of that subcommittee from the Joint Legislative Audit Committee, is to use that as the mechanism for statutory requests for audits so that they can be funneled and we can prioritize them and kind of do it in a logical fashion as opposed to using bills and statutes. So mm-hmm. you might see some bills come through that have audit requirements in them, and I just kind of maybe put up your feelers when you see those come through that we may end up opposing them, not because the concept of the audits are bad, but just because the mechanism that's already established in statute is the one that we would prefer to see audits and ideas for audits go through.
Right.
So,
Members, I can, in following up on Kathy's comment, I can tell you that House Bill 2028 will be coming back to us. It's already here. It hasn't gone anywhere. But it will be going somewhere. We will eventually be moving that out. We're just looking at it to see if there's any other changes that we want to make. Because one of the things that in the currently with the Joint Legislative Audits Committee, as Kathy mentioned, there is a requirement that the co-chair of Ways and Means sit on that committee, and that's one of the reasons why during session the Joint Legislative Audits Committee has not been functional in the past. And so one of the things that House Bill 2028 does is changes the membership so that it doesn't have to, you might have a member of Ways and Means on the committee, but they don't have to be the chair, and you don't have to have the co-chairs involved, because as we know, Ways and Means during session is in their own world. And so I do appreciate your comments about that, and that yes, I think 2028 does roll very nicely with this particular bill as well, and it will be moving eventually. That's all I want to say.
Maybe one more quick real comment on this. Mr. Chair, the fiscal impact concept came up, and I also don't know what the this does is it removes some requirements for us so that we can use our resources elsewhere. So
right.
There isn't any additional requirements on us as part of this bill. So I see no fiscal. So.
Okay, thank you. Members, let me just point out Section 8. Kathy mentioned something about the sheriff's stuff. Section 8 repeals ORS 206.320. I went and looked that up the other day, and basically what it says is that it's a fairly short statute. Basically what it says is that when sheriffs perform services for the state, could be of any kind of variety of services, then the audits division has to go in and audit their books to make sure that they billed correctly and that everything was paid, and you know, all of that kind of stuff. I think it's a fairly innocuous repealing of the statute. So I think it's fine looking at that. Thank you, Kathy. Let me have Bob. You want to come on up and this is Bob Keith, and if you would, make sure you just state your name for the record. And
good morning, Chair Kimmel and members of the committee. My name is Bob Keith. I'm the administrator of the Appraiser Certification and Licensure Board. Our board is named in this bill because it's not a part of ORS 182, which is where most of the semi-independent agencies reside. The language in the respective bills with respect to reporting requirements are identical. And the Appraiser Certification Licensure Board has no desire to be different from the other semi-independent agencies in 182. And so this bill would change our statute to match 182, and we support it.
Great.
That's all I have to say. If
that's it,
questions,
huh?
I can try to answer them, but we just want to let you know that we're in favor of the change.
Okay. Okay, I have to admit that I found it very interesting that your particular board was called out in this bill, and I thought, oh, that's interesting. But now I understand the reason for it. So thank you for clarifying that. Are there any questions for Mr. Keith?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Appreciate it. And thank you for just kind of sitting here while we went through all of this stuff. Okay. There is no one else. Well, did you want to say anything about House Bill 2027? I'm sorry. I know I recognize you, but I...
Just briefly, Mr. Chair. David Pluckett with the Oregon Board of Optometry. We also are one of those semi-independent agencies, and I would say that the system that we've been using with Secretary of State doing the contracting has worked well, and I think because there are so many semi-independents, that might be the best way to do it, is for them to manage it. I would ask that they be careful, though, about the the time that they spend with it, because it does add on to the cost of what we end up paying, and as long as they're careful with that, I'm okay with it. I think it makes sense for them to do this for all the boards at one time, but it does add to the cost. We really have no problems with the financial review versus audit, and from that standpoint, and I think it's worked quite well. A question I didn't hear Kathy speak to it, and maybe this bill doesn't address it, but does this have anything to do with the frequency of the reviews or audits?
That's a good question, and I I think that the only thing that it talks about with regards to frequency, if I'm not mistaken, is in section 2, it just describes that the that there will be provided a report on the financial reviews that have been done, and the most recent reviews are the ones that will be reported on. That's the only thing that I think is where there's anything having to do with any kind of time frame. And Kathy, am I correct in that?
Just real briefly, Mr. Chair, we do it once every 2 years, so there is a report for the Legislative Assembly.
So those reviews are done once every 2 years, even for all of the semi-independent agencies and so on?
That's correct.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I just had a concern if that was going to be reduced. We're very conscious of being a semi-independent agency, of having the reviews and maintaining accountability. And from that standpoint, we'd like for the reviews to be done.
Okay.
But we are in favor of the bill.
Okay. Thank you very much. I think that is one reason why they want to change the terminology from audit to financial review, because then that means that they don't have to spend as much time and it doesn't cost you as much. So I think that's Representative Butler, did you have a question for Mr. Plunkett before we let him stand there?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and it does change that from an audit to a review. And my question was relative to the financial review. Have you, in the past, it indicates that you've been receiving a financial audit. And my anticipation is, from what I know of the cost, and if the Secretary of State's office contracts this out, a financial review could be significantly less expensive. Are you anticipating that you need a financial audit? Because we're changing that from an audit to a financial review. So, Dave, do you anticipate that you would need a higher level?
Chair Cromwell, Representative Butler, no, I don't think so. I think you could probably even reduce the frequency, because I think they have found that, for the most part, things have been in good order.
Mr. Chair, but I would address the frequency issue. The frequency isn't addressed here, because the frequency provides that will be produced for the first day of the regular legislative session, which is every session, every 2 years. So yeah. we're not addressing the frequency. We are addressing the level of service. And again, Kathy shakes her head yes, that a financial audit is normally considerably more expensive than that of a financial review. So I'm anticipating, Dave, that there should be some savings, but my question is, do you feel like the financial audit is somehow something that you would need? I wouldn't think it would be, but that's, again, the scope of that, I think, could be contracted or could be discussed and then contracted as the Secretary of State may elect to contract for that financial review with the independent CPAs.
Chair Cromwell, Representative Butler, no, I think that the review is adequate, and particularly since they will have some flexibility in how they can do that review, I think that will work fine.
Mr. Chair, I just go back to my earlier comments. Number one, that a financial review is considerably less in scope than that of a financial audit, but that if you've got good people who understand the importance of internal control, then you can go ahead and focus your resources on the high-risk areas as opposed to scatter shooting the flock in that regard. And I just have to, particularly in these agencies where we've got good folks, Mr. Keith, Mr. Plank, the other folks involved on a regular basis, I would think that it wouldn't be necessary to go in with full-blown audits every 2 years, that financial reviews would be appropriate, particularly, again, where they've demonstrated the ability to have the internal controls and protect those internal controls. And that's easily examined normally. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I think you're right. And the key here is that there is a flexibility that can be so if it's warranted for one reason or another, maybe the financial review starts picking up things that are a little bit odd, and it's determined that a full audit is called for. That authority is not necessarily taken away from the Secretary of State's office to be able to do this. Okay. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Now, I don't see anyone else that might want to testify on House Bill 2027, so I'm going to close the public hearing. Let me go ahead and open a work session on House Bill 2027. And we don't have any amendments for this bill. Based on what you've heard today, what would the desire of the committee be?
Mr. Chair, the two people that have not come forward, and I don't anticipate a problem, particularly in having read ORS 206-320, relative this statute for sheriffs must have been placed in there somewhere shortly after 1859. Where sheriffs would do the work of investigation of certain types of issues, and the other people that I don't see at the table today are the certified public accountants. But as Kathy's indicated, we're not really changing any of the method by which we go about employing their services in state government. So, relative to that, I would move that we move House Bill 2027. As presented to the floor of the House, we'll do pass recommendation. Well, that's right. I beg your pardon. I retract that we move it to the Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. That's right.
Okay.
Pardon. Correct.
All right. Representative Butler has moved House Bill 2027 to the Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
I have a question, Mr. Chair.
Representative Binko.
Well, I'm a little perplexed why it's being referred to Ways and Means after I reminded Representative Butler. And is there a possibility that we could recommend that the Ways and Means referral be rescinded?
We can, and I'll tell you what. Let's do this. Let me have a stand at ease for a couple of minutes. I won't recess us. We'll just stand at ease for a couple of minutes. And Jim, would you just give the speaker's office a call and see if let them know what we found here.
We'll
stand at ease.
Mr. Chair, how are people doing, Jim?
I would like to go ahead, and my motion was that we pass 2027 on to the Ways and Means, but I also recognize that House Bill 2028 and other bills may be associated with other Secretary of State's issues, which probably need to be approached more holistically. So I'm going to retract my motion, which has not been voted upon.
The chair will accept that, and I think that is a good point given 2028 and a couple of the other bills. So I think hanging on to this for just a few more days won't hurt anything at all, and that also will give me the opportunity to clarify with the speaker's office the subsequent referral delays and means. Okay, so with that, I'm going to go ahead and close the work session on House Bill 2027, and since we don't have anything else before us today, wait. You have been provided a copy of the response to questions from the Department of Administrative Services that were asked of them, and I would just point out that this is relevant to House Bill 2474, which is assigned to this committee. And so when you're filing this information, you may want to file it with that specific bill. Okay?
Mr. Chair,
yes,
relative to the information on House Bill 2474 and going through the list of fees, I find some very interesting comments for fees that were imposed in the 0305, one of which I thought was somewhat remarkable, and that is from the Board of the State Board of Pharmacy, a fee for remote dispensing machines. absolutely left to wonder as to what that might include. And then also for the Department of Fish and Wildlife,
an increase in the annual fee for developmental fisheries permit. And I'm just not sure what developmental fisheries are, so I'll follow up and find out what some of these things are. But
learning impaired fish.
Okay, I'm going to check.
Learning impaired fish.
I'm going to check around to see if I can find any of these remote vending sites for the Department of Pharmacy.
Okay, sounds good. Sounds good. Thank you, Representative. And thank you, members, and we will see you Thursday. With that, we will stand adjourned.